Thank you, brethren, for having me speak today. I'm just going to start passing around a few things, and I'll just give you an explanation of what they are. This is a map of Africa and Uganda so that you have some context when we're talking, and a map of Kampala, which is the city that we're in Uganda. And I have the convention report by Brother Juko, and it's the first two pages, and then the rest are actually the convention program. You can see what the convention was outward. And then the last two are the newsletters that they distribute in Uganda that are written both in English and in the native language that they translate, and you can see the topics and what they're trying to witness to and trying to have people hear in the truth. And then the last two things are the toys that I brought back for the kids is that the brethren's families and the children actually made these for the kids. And they made a ball for my son and a doll for my daughter. These are banana leaves. And banana trees are very prevalent, that they're all around their homes, and basically very much a staple of their food that they make from mash and other types of banana products. And so the leaves, just as a castaway thing, is everywhere, so that you can always recycle them and make them toys for the kids. I don't want to make this a discourse. I'm just a traveler that returned, and I just wanted to give a report back again. So I'm going to kind of give just a brief outline. Hopefully it'll be brief if I don't, run long. And then I'll let the brethren's questions guide the rest, because that will really give me a focus. It's always a little hard to balance the culture that they're trying to get, as well as the concept of the brethren and the truth that they understand as well. My dad contacted me originally to go to Uganda, and he really took me along as an encouragement to me to try and have truth activity and truth work, which is really a blessing for me, and I appreciate that. I didn't know anything about Uganda. It's the middle of Africa. It's kind of the heart of Africa, if you look at it, where it is on the map. And it's always been Christian. Uganda has always been a Christian country. Before that it was primitive religion, but first missionaries who were always trying to find the source of the Nile, of course, the source of the Nile is in Uganda. It's Lake Victoria. And that is the largest tributary to the Nile. It's called the White Nile. There's another tributary, the Blue Nile, which comes out of Ethiopia. But here at Lake Victoria, where we flew into, is the very source of the Nile, which of course flows north, unlike most rivers that flow south. But they've always remained Christian. They've never given in to the Islamic influence. They're surrounded by other violent countries. You have the Sudan to the north, which they have a president that's a war criminal now, wanted by the UN. And if he ever leaves the country, and they're hoping to get him on a plane, corner him on a plane someplace, that they'll take him into the Hague for trial. You have Rwanda, where ethnic violence just broke out. You have Kenya, where ethnic violence just broke out. And you have Congo, which is still in turmoil, and they have constant violence on throughout the country still. And then you have Uganda in the middle, which is basically has a truce that they have the north, which is still in war, and they have the south, which is in peace for about 20 years. But they've stopped trying to solve their ethnic conflicts with the north. They have a lot of problems, and the north, the northern regime, which is just a warlord, kidnap children from the south, and it's an ongoing problem. I flew into Amsterdam, and I saw the Ad and Olga Klinker, which are the last brethren in Holland. There used to be an ecclesia there, and there isn't anymore. They still try and witness, and they have a few people that are interested, but they're older, and that's basically the demographic that they try and talk to. And it seems like that the truth will kind of die out as an ecclesia group when they finally pass. We got into the convention on Wednesday. Well, it was the day before. So Tuesday we flew in, Tuesday night, and we flew into Entebbe, which Entebbe, of course, is famous for the Israeli raid when Idi Amin allowed the Palestinians to land the hijacked plane, and the Israelis flew in and recaptured all of them except for one, and got everyone back safely. We drove through the night to Kampala, which is about an hour away, which is the capital of Uganda. And we got to our hotel, which is about a five or six story building that is on the edge of Old Taxi Park, which was the original area of Kampala. And so this is our hotel, but also the convention was there as well. So we were on the third floor and our rooms, and then the fifth floor was where the convention was held. When we got the program, if the brothers can see the program as it comes around, we were a little concerned that they had never had a convention before, and all they had to look at was American convention programs to say, what are they going to talk about? How do you lay one out? How do you organize one? And so the convention program had the days set out where we would have an hour for praise and thanksgiving in the morning. We would have 2 hours of a presentation. No break into a hour and a half presentation by another brother into 30 minutes of questions before lunch. And then we would do another four-hour block of this sort without any type of a break. The brethren, and this is just cultural, it's one of the different types of things, is that's what they felt would really be best for them, is to have a stream of truth that would come throughout the entire day. And the brethren would kind of dip into it where they could, and sometimes if you had to leave for a bit, the brethren got up and they left and they would come back, and it was kind of at their own discretion. I was a little concerned when I first saw the convention program, not only because of these time blocks, this is like a lot of time and a lot of serious work, but I was actually on the convention program as a speaker. And I haven't done that before, and I'm not an elder, and speaking at a convention, and I didn't know exactly how that would work out. And I wrote my concerns to the brother in Africa just to let him know of my position, that I've never been an elder, and that's not usually done here. And he wrote back that it was not a problem, that if I had been someone of truth and someone of long-standing, then they would like to hear what I had to say. My father encouraged me as well, and hopefully I was able to bring the message of the Holy Spirit to the brethren. And I was willing to serve wherever the brethren want me to, and I guess that was my idea, is if people wanted me to serve in some fashion, then I would do whatever was being called upon to the brethren. There was a lot of very heavy topics. The brethren themselves seemed to have a understanding of the chart. We had a chart there, and they understood the concepts of the chart. They had all gone through the first volume. Some of them, some of the sisters from Congo were illiterate, and they couldn't read any language, not even their native language. So they had to receive the first volume orally from usually their husbands, who would read it to them, or in their case, or other sorts of materials. Also, the Congo brethren don't usually speak English. Their normal language is French. They have their Swahili and other types of tribal languages, but French and English dominated between Uganda English and the Congo French. So we had brethren from the Congo that were visiting, and also from Kenya. The topic, so we didn't discuss a lot of the very basic things about the truth. It was really a convention just like it would be here. There's a lot of discussion of what the basis of your foundation is, and we're all here because we've already learned and accepted the truth. In fact, there were 8 consecrated brothers that were there, but that counted the 3 from Kenya as well. We talked about the tabernacle, a lot about sanctification, about following Jesus in your life. for the topic as far as Brother Allen actually had the capstone. He had a 2.5-hour presentation. And in the heat of Africa, it is really impressive that the brother had stepped up to this task and really were able to speak with that amount of time. One of the cultural things is after someone is done, there's no break, the next person steps up and to speak. But when someone's done, everyone applauds. And it is a cultural thing. You know, in America, we would consider that, you know, somewhat improper, or but, you know, after you speak for 2 hours, you know, it's hard not to clap for Christ. It's very impressive. We were there for only a week, and we were scheduled for, let's see, 3 days of convention, 3 days of speaking, and then the fourth day was all arranged as a fellowship day. And we had brothers' homes that we were going to see. But when we got through the 3 days of convention, which was from early in the morning, and we had the half an hour lunch break, and then by late at night, you were pretty tired and ready to cash in for the next day. On the last day, we were kind of expecting more of an easier going day, but that was the day for the brother in question. And we had three groups set up where the brothers would switch the groups, and actually there were four groups, because we had Brother Krishino from India, and there's Brother Alan Springer, myself, and my father, Brother Jerry. And the four groups of brethren all split up, and then they would switch and ask us different questions and try and get all their questions answered, which was a huge amount of the convention. I mean, it was really important to the convention, because we had these four-hour presentation times where the brethren didn't get to ask any questions about the topics, about the things that came up. We were basically lecturing for 4 hours at a block, and then they had a half an hour of questions. You know, and sometimes you don't have questions. If you could have two questions and ask the whole half an hour, and then it's time to go on to another four-hour block of discourses. The brethren didn't bring their children. They had always been left someplace else, except for the very young. If we had babies or infants, they would bring those because of the attachment to the mother. But at a certain age, they don't bring the children to the meeting, and it's mostly an adult affair. We found that Christianity was very big. There was a lot of born-agains, Episcopalians, and Catholics. And on the streets, because of our looking significantly different than everybody else, people asked us why we were there. And they were extremely receptive to us being there because of Christian purposes. We were able to hand out a lot of the newsletters just because we were the tall white guys. And it was a blessing, and they didn't seem to have any hesitancy towards this. The most surprising thing we found talking to just common Ugandans, these people from Uganda, as well as the brethren, is the most impressive thing is we removed the priest from the relationship with God. This was the most startling thing to them, is they did not have to be told what to do. It wasn't a passive relationship. Being a Christian wasn't something passive unless you became a priest and made it your life. And a lot of these people had tried to do that. And a lot of these brethren, these people attending, really had tried to do that in some sense. They felt the call to God so much that they had attachments before to churches. They had become lay ministers. There's a lot of these positions that are paid in Africa that are considered a profession. You know, a profession. Religion is a profession, and it's a very good one. And it's something that's supported. But they never found that authenticity, relationship with God. And a lot of them had to make sacrifices for their lives to become brethren. You know, one of the things is you don't get to attach this to your livelihood anymore. You know, you have to do something different, and then your Christianity becomes authentic. You know, your relationship to God becomes authentic. And that is what they were really looking for. People on the street would say that too. When they were just students coming to talk to other students, it was a startling thing. We're not coming as authority figures. or people to step in and tell them what to do. And you saw some of those things in the questions. You know, one of the questions is a sister had been baptized as an Episcopalian years earlier. And she had just loved the divine plan and wanted to know, we had been discussing baptism and baptism and his death. Did she need to be rebaptized again? Did she have to do this? You know, we were going to a baptism. We baptized two brand new brothers in Lake Victoria. Did she have to have this be done again? The answer is, when you understand what real baptism is, you get to decide if you were baptized authentically before or you weren't, and you have to be rebaptized. What kind of answer is that? You know, I asked you to tell me what I should be doing. And you don't, that's not how authentic faith with our relationship with Jesus and with God is. You know, it's something that's startling them to them because it's an authentic relationship that you can have through Jesus. And I found that so refreshing, that appreciation. You know, here in the United States, we have people like me who grew up in the truth. And maybe I don't have the correct appreciation because I never had any other type of idea. And then you have a lax atmosphere among Christians in general that, you know, this idea just never seems as startling as it really is. And for people in Africa that make such a public display of their religion, where it becomes part of the society, you talk about it at work, you talk about it on the streets, you talk about it when you go into the internet cafe, you talk about it everywhere, that this is a revolutionary idea as it is. We went to the brethren's homes. They live very simply, a lot of times about running water and other things. They live communally, where your home is. The local group of women, you know, do their laundry together. They raise their children together. When we go to the brethren's homes, the home would immediately fill up with children. And these were the local children who saw a car and white people getting out of the car, and that's time to go over there and see what it's all about. A lot of them had never really experienced people this close from other parts of the world. You know, they hear about things and they have an impression, but their livelihood is very simple in the sense that it's uncomplicated. You know, you don't have to worry so much about the bureaucracy that we live in America. Brother Chuko's home had a wonderful grove of bananas around that included orange trees, avocados, sugar cane, beans, pineapples, just amazing variety of things that they would have. And then the neighbors would have goats, and you would let the goats graze on your land, and then when it's time to slaughter the goat, got a portion of the goat. And that's how you do it. If you have a job and you make a living, that's a real benefit to you in other ways, but it's not necessary. You know, life is a lot, can be devoted fully to your spirituality in a lot different sense than we think of it here. You know, this convention started on a Wednesday, on a work day, and went through the rest of the week. And that seems completely appropriate for them to have people from Kenya and Congo to come to this. And we would not probably do that. We'd try to have a weekend or a holiday where people could get off work and it would be convenient for them in their social schedule, so that wasn't so much of a concern. I felt that we really touched people in a way because they recognized that this is a small group. Being able to commit yourself this fully and authentically in a relationship to Jesus is something that it will always be a small group. It can never rise to engulf the world now in a sinful condition. And they saw that that ties them specifically to their brethren all over the world. You know, with the Romanians that Brother Allen was representing, from the Americans here, and that we're all part of a family. They had no problem talking about me as a white person. It's obvious there's been a lot, you know, country of people who look significantly different. Why wouldn't they talk about my obvious difference? But that's not considered racist to them. It's tribalism, talking about each other's tribes, to say, you're of this tribe and that tribe. That's comparing each other. And because they take very big stake of their tribal relationships, their families. Religion becomes a kind of extension of that, of what religion you are, and now you're part of this other tribe. For them, when they became Bible students, when they accepted these truths and this fellowship, they became part of our tribe. We are their family. And they understand that they have joined this smaller group to join this larger global group that is part of these universal doctrines. And I'll leave some time for questions right now by just saying that I really, really appreciate this experience because there are so many cultural differences. Because when I went there, it was so foreign and odd and things were so different that the thing that remained to relate me to these people and to bond them to me and us to find commonality is the truth. And the truth is universal in a way that applies to all these different, that appeals to all these different types of cultures. You know, for them, this idea of global salvation, historical salvation of the kingdom, is the best thing that they've ever heard. And that's always what we have applied to when we talk to people about the truth, is that it's the best thing you're ever going to hear. And for them as well. I kind of jumped around, but that is kind of my outline, and I'll let the brethren have some questions. What is that?
You mentioned the kingdom as one of the doctrines that they like. I mean, compared to the kinds of doctrines that, you know, Americans find that attract them to the truth, is it similar as far as the other doctrines? I mean, we get some, especially that are attracted by the kingdom, but also that here that are repelled by doctrines that don't show God's love, like hellfire and so forth, various issues about salvation, and that we encompass a greater number than the churches do, and in a more loving plan of salvation. Is it a similar kind of thing, or do they have very specific ideas of what attracts them to the truth, what makes them see it different from the other Christian religions there?
Well, I would say it's similar. But they just bring it forward a little differently. The metaphors of Scripture are extremely appealing. The robe of Christ's righteousness was a wonderful thing that they, you know, we talked quite a bit about this robe of Christ that covers us. You know, the idea is the same, is that we are covered, Jesus, and then we have this robe that we keep clean during the process where we realize that we make errors and mistakes, and we bring this to Jesus. You know, for these brethren, you know, the idea of the robe and the metaphor, you know, the wise and faithful virgins, you know, these types of metaphors really resonate with them. The wedding ceremony, of course, resonates with them because it is more close to their wedding ceremonies than it is to ours. You know, the ideas of the bridegroom and the wedding people, you know, the people who receive them and having sacrifices and a party and these type of festivities, you know, that's still very common in their society. I really liked how they, I guess I learned to appreciate deeper the idea of our own covering, of our own relationship. For them, it goes back to this idea that their covering was the priest. It was someone telling them what to do. And tells them, you know, and they were always having the condemnation. It was always someone telling you, you're not good, you're not right, you're acting incorrectly. You know, look at some so-and-so over here, and they're doing better than you. And it was this guilt complex. But the idea of the robe of Christ's righteousness upon us, and we have stains and we have wrinkles, and we work these out differently. And it's not with someone else telling us what to do. It's with our Lord and Master Jesus directing us what to do with his, from his life. And that is, I think, a freeing element, a personally freeing element that allows them to think about the deeper things, the deeper metaphors, the tabernacle, the times and the seasons, our relationship with the population around us.
A follow-up on that. So, have they been taught by other Christians, other Christian denominations, have they been, not taught, but have they been treated, let's call it, as elementary age students? I mean, have they been, have they not been, it sounds like they've just, from other Christian religions, just learned simple rules to guide their lives and to, you must do this, must not do that. And it's almost like they've been treated as infants. And here Bible students are now saying, you have a mind, you are worth something more than that, you can think for yourself.
I'm trying to think of a period in American history that would be similar. That's exactly correct. There is no Bible, going back to the Bible movement, there has never been any encouragement for Bible study. There's never been any encouragement to have to deepen your life through personal exploration of the scriptures. It is a church group that you go to. You devote yourself to one denomination. You go to their services. They tell you what to do. And you get the benefits or the problems from that relationship.
No asking questions.
I think there might be some individuals, the priests, but everything is a taught relationship. Now we see a little bit of this authoritarian idea with the Bible students in general that have grown in Africa. We find that there, in every ecclesia, there is one elder and only one elder. The idea of two elders is a mystery to them. How would that work? You know, you have two, three, four? You know, no, there's one elder, and he kind of directs things, and the brethren have a lot more participation than they did in the other churches. They have, you know, kind of a pseudo-election, but they definitely look to the elder for his opinion and his idea. It's more like a chieftain type of an idea. He's the head of the tribe. And when people disagree, he says, this side stands, that side doesn't. Life goes on. And it's a part of their culture and society for order. One of the most anticipated things was that they put something on the program that had never been considered. A panel. That they were confused about this. And even Brother Crescino, Brother Miranda Crescino, hadn't been on a panel before. India.
Yeah.
And he had extensive work. Brother Crescino was the one who had originally founded this ecclesia and had done several others throughout Africa. He had a lot of travels throughout Africa. When we were in Uganda, we saw a lot of Indians, native Indians, is that they have a lot of business work there. The most outstanding feature of the city is a Hindu temple that flashes lights on it during the night. And the Hindus that work there, that travel from India to work in Uganda, are mostly all Hindus. So Brother Krishna was an oddity to have a Christian Indian there. They were really interested in the panel because they believed that it would have been divisive between the brothers, that we would have had different opinions and broken out in some type of argument. And, of course, it's probably one of the most American parts of the convention because the brethren naturally comment and appreciate each other's, and they build their thoughts off of each other. They wait to make sure the others haven't had, you know, have said something or are done with their thought before they introduce. And I think that was really stimulating to see how that's possible. And I think that was a real different cultural idea maybe not a completely spiritual one either way, not wrong or right, but it was just different culturally that they hadn't thought about. And that was nice.
I have a question from the Leslie camp here. It says, could Aaron tell something about their personal testimonies at the convention? That's something that was odd as well. Something singing testimonies, I guess you added in here.
That on the last day before, the brethren sang, of course, all the way through it. You know, singing and I think dancing is very a big part of Ugandan culture. And they sang with their hearts. The brethren loved singing. They would have the singing in the morning. It would go on 3 or 4 hymns. And that was a good way to just delay things for brethren that hadn't arrived yet. And the brothers especially would often sing a solo during the testimonies to express their heart. And culturally, that is something that you don't usually see. And, you know, it was really that livelihood with the truth, too, where they really felt the heartfelt spirit in their singing. The Oh Happy Day that we sang this morning was one of their hymns. And you can just kind of hear the African, the grab of it, you know, just the African grab of the song was the Oh Happy Day. And they would introduce, you know, this is the day that the Lord has made. And it would actually be a kind of, in part of the morning Bethel, that would be kind of the call and response that would raise the group. You know, what day has the Lord made? It's this day, you know, and it's very enthusiastic. Brother Crescino was really a very avid, expressive speaker. And you can see why people were attracted to his charisma in that. You know, he really had a way of bringing the truth forward. You know, his first service was on the tabernacle, and it was incredibly animated and vivid. And it really hit the brethren just right in that need for metaphors and pictures, you know, for those concepts. On the last day when we had just the fellowship, the Congo brethren sang a song together, which I have on the video. And they sang it in their native Congolese language. And I think it was Oh Happy Day, and Kepel is all in Congolese. And that's just a wonderful thing, too. And I hope that addresses the point.
Oh, it sounds like they weren't shy, but they were very expressive in everything they did.
Well, I think, you know, this is natural shyness that I think even we have. You know, you go to a convention, and you kind of see the brethren really animated and really participatory during the services and the discourses and really, but you know, suddenly you go to lunch and everyone's a little more shy and reserved.
Yes, this is Brother Crescino here.
Brother Crescino, yes. And you can see it was hot that we had. You know, sometimes we had suits and ties, and sometimes we had shirt sleeves. And we had the brothers would sing, and they would testify, and it was really about their personal experience. You know, we see a shy, you know, just an American brethren. Well, it's always easier to let some of the others testify or tell about their lives. And here there was no reservation. It was essential to tell about their own experience, you know, and their own finding something that was unique for them. I'm sorry, I missed one of the questions.
It was about testimony.
The testimony. The singing testimony. This is around the street. I didn't get very far outside my hotel. I basically went to the hotel, and it lasted all day. And in the evening, I could go down to the streets, which was, this is outside of my hotel window. And extremely busy, lots of people. Everyone's selling things from the streets. Is that because of a poor culture, you know, you want to represent your goods and services as the most economic around. And the best way to do that is even though you could afford to sell them from a shop, you want to sell them from the streets because that shows that there's no overhead. And you're giving them the very best deal possible. So everything is offered on the streets. This is Brother Juko. This is the elder of Kapala, the Uganda elder. it's hard. This is Brother Levy in here, and Brother Silver, and there's Brother Israel, and this is Sister Usha. Sister Sarah was Brother Juko's wife. And you can see the sisters all have their head covered. Sister Dorcas from Congo.
Are they supposed to have to come in
with
this?
No. Yes, religious names are very popular. Brother Juko, we always refer to him as Brother Juko, which it was his last name. You know, there's just some odd conventions with first and last names. And his first name was Eliezer Juko. And let's see, my father and the brethren around this table, that we had waters all the time. There was just some oddities about the convention where we had a chairman, but sometimes the chairman would share his own discourse. And it was the very first convention, and there was a lot of differences, and maybe that the brethren will give him feedback after. So it would be a little different. I don't know that answer. I'm thinking that it's maybe 3 or 4 years old.
Well, that was kind of along the line of my question is, I don't know if I missed this in your discussion here, but how did the truth find its way into this country?
There's been lots of brethren who have tried to do small and different things, and they get some interested, and the brethren in Kenya and other places often go to other African countries. You have to understand, Africa is kind of like the United States with a lot of bunch of little states together that don't get along. And, you know, it wouldn't be odd for us to say we have an opportunity in Pennsylvania and to go there and maybe do a public witness. For them, going to somewhat another country, another African country, would be similar. I know the brethren have said that they were brought in either by others in conversation, and some with posters that were on the wall that were how to study the Bible and make it make sense. How to study the Bible is a huge witness message in Africa because that's something that they've never been offered before. You know, is to say, how do you study the Bible? You know, usually it's, let us tell you what the Bible says. Brother Lang?
Well, now you've touched on something that is precious to me, how to study the Bible,
yes,
because of our involvement here. And you say that that is special because of the fact that it goes back to that original thing of them being able to, as it were, not be told, but to ask questions and to learn. And I appreciate that. Can you mention to the brethren here specifically what you told me in reference to means of how we can help them get how to study the Bible and have it make sense?
I also wanted to add on to that. It's not only just about the scriptures, but it is about the way we have the truth, too. The volumes are extremely important to them. Reprints, they get newsletters from the brethren, they get emails. Some of them have emails. All of them have mail, some P.O. box. So physical things as well. Around Memorial Time, the consecrated brethren are actually mailed matzahs from the American brethren, so they can participate in a way that they feel is more authentic.
They have the grapes
down
there, right?
Yeah, they have grapes, something of that sort. They also have a DVD that they have called the 53 Steps, and that basically goes through Bible student doctrine at a study a week. And that will get you through Bible student doctrine in a year and a week. And the brethren would often refer to each other in these codes, like, what did you think of lesson, when you got to lesson 9, didn't that, wasn't that a shocker to you at lesson 9? And, I don't know what they're talking about. you know, they had one of the titles is The Truth About Hell, and the brethren would say, well, when they got to that one, they were extremely afraid. Not because of what was said, but because they hadn't read it yet. And they thought, well, here we go. Here's where I'm condemned to hell, and everything I've done is probably going to come out, and I'm a loser who will never make it. And then they read this section about the truth about hell, and it's a complete revolution to them. And it's a wonderful, instead of they have this fear, it's almost that deep set fear that they had, and the joy of being lifted out of it. And isn't that a great Christian message as well? So the other thing about this answer, Brother Laddie, is they have the email, they have regular snail mail, and then everyone has cell phones. The joke about Africa is you'll never be able to find an African without a cell phone, and probably just as unlikely that you'll find one without his life. So they all have cell phones. It's a basic way of just keeping in contact with everyone. And one of the ideas is to try and develop some type of text witnessing idea. Here in America, we collect emails, and then we say, can we send you updates about conventions and good thoughts and things of this sort and booklets? And they would do the same thing with cell phones, is they can collect people's cell phone numbers, and then they can put together a little text message email witness and then mass it out to everyone who they have their cell phones.
I just have a comment from Jerry and Sharon. It says, Eliezer Junko found Oakland County website with volumes, then connected this India brother, K-H-U-R-R-S-I-N-O, traveling to Africa.
Krishino.
So is that the brother that
that's
you have on the screen? So that's what they're saying, that he came through Oakland County website and then connected with the brother traveling in Africa. Yes.
Yeah, and that's really, it's amazing how people find the truth. Seekers will find it. And, they're incredibly enthusiastic about it. Any other questions? For the bill?
I want to pause everything here.
And I'm not watching the time, so someone will have to stop.
We aren't either.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's no. Yeah. We have a 4-hour block.
That they had. It was more business. You see these business models that they kind of go off on. Brother Juco was part of a computer group before this, and he had business meetings, and that's how we kind of based our order off of, as well as a semi-business model. And it was actually kind of a joke because one time Brother Jackson was late and his fellow brothers, kind of rubbed it in that he's a timekeeper. And you can see the love of people when they're able to kid each other that way. That's really nice. Good to go.
Overall, the African people seem to have, as manifest with those that are here in the States, too, have a lot of emotional, more dancing, more singing, more emotional response. And because of that, the general, let's say from the worldly Christian evaluation of Africa, because of this mainly emotional level of belief rather than anything deeper, anything more substantial, they often say that Africa is, in faith, is a mile wide and an inch deep. In other words, very shallow faith, mostly built on emotion. But we see here, from what you're showing us, and by looking at that outline you can't pass out, that's certainly not an inch deep with these brethren. That's very deep, and is Africa spoken of that way because really the Christians have not given them anything to sink their teeth into, or what?
I see that its prejudice is built into this old-time religion. Religion used to be based on dominating a clergy-laity type of relationship, and they never thought at one time of ever trying to go outside of that. And it's remained that way in Africa. And I think because of their third world status, that whenever people go there for aid or for religion or for anything else, there's a prejudice that treats them like children. Absolutely true. This group, there was no doubting the deepness of their thought, of their philosophy, of their concepts, they're able to conceive these things. Like I said, the idea of the chart, you know, in a way I thought I was going to go and talk about the chart, talk about dispensations, and, you know, the ideas of the Holy Spirit and Jesus in relationship to God. But no. What we talked about was, you can see the questions here, at the depth of the questions, tabernacle sacrifices, the times and the seasons. Says Michael's coming to aid Gabriel in his fight against the Prince of Persia to help us understand Jesus' return in 1874.
Wow.
I mean, and we went into this, and it was hard for me to get so much at one time, to hear it all at one time. It was a blessing to me. And, you know, all I could look around at the brethren, and they were quiet and attentive and writing. Always writing. This universality among Bible student culture is that's what you do. You listen, you write, and you write, and you write. You ask questions. I'm asking questions. And we still ask questions. You know, and sometimes the brethren's questions were so deep that our response was, I don't know. I don't know. And to hear that from someone that they keep trying to put in that authority, you know, you're the authority. And from our response is, I don't know. You have to look into it. You have to get your teeth into it. You seem to be real interested in that topic. Sanctification of the Spirit unto obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus. My personal presentation was to be filled with the Holy Spirit, pray in the Holy Spirit, witness of the Holy Spirit, sealing of the Holy Spirit. And I'd like to publicly thank my mother-in-law for helping me out with that. Her study and notes were exceptional as helping in this service. Making a call on my election, sure. Obey and hearken. But, you know, always back to the pictures of sacrifice. My dad gave a wonderful discourse on love and the quatermarks of love and the essentials of love in our lives. And it was interesting that my dad said that he had not had an opportunity before to speak on the topic of love. You know, and he's spoken on so many deep topics before and so many things. You know, being able to present the ideas of love from that depth of background, I just found such a wonderful witness. It's just a wonderful thing. Any other questions?
Billy, I will put Bill at the end. I was just thinking about how their environment there is just ripe for the invasion of the Islamic religion.
Point out, did you see that sign?
Read the Quran.
The Lord said, read the Quran.
Right, right.
So, are they
right. Well, the thing, I saw the minaret there in one of your pictures, and I just wondered if it, of course, the brethren are not going to be affected by that, but the other communities, I wondered if in your discussions with anyone and your trying to educate yourself on the culture there, I know when we went to Mexico, the oppressive papal system that came and just slaughtered, I mean, through this church and state, just slaughtered people. And that's how they converted the culture down in Mexico and South America. I wondered, of course, this would have been more missionary movement in Africa, but if they would have a resentment, some of them, for Christianity in general, and this would, I know you said the country is more Christian, but if there might be an undercurrent there of any kind of resentment toward Christianity in their past, that would welcome a Muslim religion. And I'm just trying to think down the road what the brethren might encounter that will affect them as far as persecution, either from Christians or from Muslims.
I don't think there's a resentment. Both Islam and Christianity are foreign to their country. They're not an Arab people at all. And so adapting to Islam would be just like adapting to any other foreign religion. There is, of course, always a push for Islam anywhere in Africa. Kampala is a city of Seven Hills originally. I think now there's 14 or 17 or something like that. But the original Seven Hills were mostly government buildings. And then a Catholic church, whatever the Protestant, the Episcopalian church, and then a mosque. And so those are the three major influences there. And people either associate themselves as being Hindu, Christian, or Muslim. There's still primitive, a lot of primitive practice, but you don't see it, or as part of the tourist part of things. It's all about, it's really a strong Christian nation. There isn't anyone going to be persecuted because they're Christian, because that's the majority. They don't have any resentment towards it because they, you know, with missionaries being so far back in the 1800s when they were converted, you know, when the missionaries came and converted everyone, it was economic. You became Christian because it was economically advantageous to do so. And I don't think they've ever looked back for that. And a lot of people make their choices on religion based still on economics, which actually going to benefit even that most. Unfortunately, the brethren don't have a whole lot of draw that way.
So in other words, like, they didn't have the same bloody history of conversion that, say, South America did, would have been more like in a long time ago, more in the 1600s. I don't remember when it would have been. 1600s or something like that.
They did have some oppression under the Belgians, though.
And this is, I think, going back to Brother Bill's question, I think this is why they treat them, you know, that they kind of feed them religion instead of allowing them to live it, is because compared to places like South America, where you had to really, you know, force this religion down their throats, and they didn't want to take it, Africans, you know, mostly readily took to whatever religion was most advantageous to them. They never, you know, South Americans, you could say, you know, they missed the mark of how they could have improved their culture by just adapting to the foreign religion. Instead, they kind of set their own, you know, they try to defend their own primitive religion, where Africa didn't do that so much. They readily gave it up pretty quickly. Yeah, they were very resistant to it, but that also makes people think, well, then you can just tell them anything you want. And that happens, and that is kind of what happened. Brother Lighting?
Do you have any idea as to what the cost of producing this? This is twice the size of ours from the standpoint of the number of pages.
But you have to remember, it's in the two languages, too, so maybe
yes.
It's the same size, yeah.
Mm-hmm. As far as content is concerned, but still, you have the paper and the cost of production. How often do they do this?
This is for Kampala only. This is out of Kampala, and if you see it, it does list the services that they have. They have every Saturday and Sunday. They have every Saturday they have an open service, and then Sunday they have something just for the brethren, where Brother Juko has at this hotel where we stayed, and he must have connections to, so he's able to offer something there. I don't know the cost of the newsletter itself. Among the African brethren,
do you have any idea how many they produce?
He had a stack, and I think he went to the printer. There was two editions there. There should be two editions. Or is this one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're both different. They're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And he had one that he gave us the first day, and then he had gone to the printer and picked up a batch. They must have a quick print place.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea how much it is, and if they would have told me in shilling, I probably would have forgotten what the conversion was.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Among the African brethren, they really like witnessing. They like telling people about this.
This one says May. Is it a monthly? What's it say?
Monthly, yeah.
This says April.
Yeah.
They okay. Out and they don't mail it.
I don't know how they distribute it. They gave us a stack, and as just we were outside, we were able to just hand them out to people. Especially because we were right next to the place where it was, so that was nice.
So to localize the advertising, they're not sending it all over Africa.
They might just for the content, but yeah, I don't know how they actually use it to drop people on. And they ask for correspondence. And I think it's just something about correspondence there in the back as well. Here you have the 53 steps to it, to show on the flash slide.
I do have a comment from
about that.
Your mom mentioned, if you
tell about the basketball and after they bought the clapping on the shore.
Oh.
And then your, I think it says copies, 1,500 a month.
Okay.
Now increased to 3,000 a month.
Okay, so that's quite a bit. So it is expensive.
And Brother Leon is leaving. He's going to go visit Barbara, so I sent our love.
I know that the American Brethren do help out with JUCO's costs and expenses. And he's very active in trying to do a lot of work there. The African Brethren tend to, you know, they have some difference of opinion. You know, the ones that were brought in with the 53 steps, more than maybe direct correspondence with Brethren here in the States through email and letters and things like that, tend to favor the 53 steps and say, you know, maybe this effort should go towards more of these DVDs, you know, to give that out to people that way. And, you know, the newsletter is only really for Uganda and Kampala and maybe into the Congo some, but there's a very active class in Nairobi that really has different ideas about how to do things. And, of course, as I've kind of said before, they don't work well with conflict. They work better when there's someone at the end to say one way or not the other. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we had brethren from Kenya there as well who did things a little differently.
The immersion.
So on the last, right before we left, we flew out. We traveled up and down to Lake Victoria with some of the brethren, and we had a small testimony on the side of Lake Victoria. We immersed Brother Kennedy. Brother Allen gave a nice baptismal discourse, and then we had a little testimony, and then Brother Silver said that he wanted to be immersed as well, so we had two. And my father did the immersion. There was a little discussion among the American brethren about going into Lake Victoria because there had been warnings about going in. But it was an opportunity for the brethren that shouldn't be passed up, and those peers should be put in the Lord's hands because of the little wormy bugs that came in there. Health reasons. But it was, so it was a beach we had to go down and we had to pay to get in, so that we paid for a little group before we had a study. And it's kind of it was like a Sunday afternoon, so there were people with their families and Africans with their families, kind of, you know, just kind of enjoying the day. And so we kind of wade out, you know, the two brothers and my father wade out into the water. Yeah, immersion. There should be immersion pictures.
No.
And we didn't get that. We were bit by a lot of mosquitoes, and we didn't get malaria. They get into the skin. Oh, no, those are leeches. Yeah, these are the ones that, you know, I did the research in. You have to, after you come back, you're supposed to always look in the mirror and look in the whites of your eyes because they come forward up there or in the warmer part on your wrists and your ankles. No. So it's my father, and you can see, like, there's the sporting things in the back, and there's some people that are... And Lake Victoria, they only have water if you look at the one map. They only have the one border with the lake, and the other ones are Kenya, and Tanzania, and over to the Congo. And this is a route with Lake Victoria where some of the brethren, because of their restrictions of their country, are being, you know, held in a country other than their native country, oftentimes will cross the lake to avoid the other borders.
So it's not unfamiliar to the people on tour to see a baptism going?
No, I think it was unfamiliar. Usually that they don't do with adults as much, or they would do it inside a church. So having it kind of in the raw atmosphere like this is kind of odd. There was the guys who were in their swim trunks who made comments that they said, have these men sinned so bad that they need to be washed? And so there were some hoots beforehand, but after they were immersed and we came back ashore, that people from the shore did applaud, and they seemed to be appreciative of that. Just a matter of applause. You can see this is Brother Silver here, and Brother Kennedy in his clothing.
The first name.
And the last names are more African than we weren't able to catch and remember so well. But I do have them all written down.
What was your best experience?
I think just being there for the brethren and feeling, excuse me.
Do you want some water?
No, I'm all right. And feeling that connection. You know, for me, I guess I've always grown up the brother, and all you've known me since I was just a little kid, and just to feel that I can really bring the message of Jesus and help to build up the church. You know, that's really our role here on earth, is to build up the church in this time. And I know I have my own limitations and my own obstacles and difficulties in trying to fulfill that with God. And this opportunity was just an opportunity to be with people who seemed to accept me and trust me and be so excited for things that we shared and how similar we were together. You know, going overseas, especially to someplace like Africa, you know, there's that heightened awareness how different you are. But then to be among the brethren, you realize that it's the similarities that really bind you and really make you brothers and eternal brothers. That is really just something that I'm hyper aware of, and it was just an inspiration to me, and that was a blessing I received from it. You know, walking with Jesus, when we talk about that, it becomes literal when we realize that we are working with the divine plan. We are part of God's movement forward in this plan. And to be a part of that is something, and to know that you're a part of that, to feel that, is a unique experience that you have to have and use it for the hard times of your life.
Yes, you read Dr. Boyd Hall, and you need it. And up this year. I was impressed, I think, personally, with the immersion, because
they're going into the water with an understanding. They're not just being baptized.
And
the truth has gotten to them, and they know what they're doing. And that is a blessing to see. That's universal in the truth.
The full consecration and the idea of the baptism unto death was something that we went over and discussed, and it was something extremely appreciated by the brethren, almost to a fearful stage when I had private fellowship with the brethren. The sisters especially wanted to ask me about the concept of second death. And if second death was a hell-like threat, not for punishment, but for finality. And to consecrate yourself puts you under this threat of the finality of second death. And they were very afraid of how easy it may be to fall into this condition. And I was grateful to try and show them that through the real love and mercy of God, it's extremely difficult to fall into this condition. It shouldn't be something that makes you afraid of consecration or puts that fear in consecration or overwhelms your desire and your joy to participate. It shouldn't be something that strangles you in something that is better not to risk anything. Because the Lord's mercy and His love says it's not a risk. It's not a risk to us. It's an assurity if we put ourselves in His hands.
You still have 2 minutes, huh? So 15,
4
after. 2 minutes.
I did write it. Yes, please. They don't have anything for the children. In the schools, one of the sisters is a school teacher. Religion is taught in the public schools. They teach Christianity. When she found the truth, she testified that she found a conflict with having to teach something at her job that she no longer believed is true. So she worked out the problem by exchanging responsibilities with another one of her colleagues, so that he took all the religion classes and she took all of his physics or something else classes. And she was able to take care of it that way. So the basis of Jesus and those types of things are kind of taught in the public schools. The kids sung songs from the schools that were Little Baby Jesus, and I forget what the other songs, but they were religious in tone. They were Christian in tone. And you find we had some very intelligent, there was one of, not a consecrated person, but someone that was interested, a Richard, who was at there and had correspondence with my father, and he's a professor in physics at the university. And talking with him, you realize that religion and physics and science all wrapped together are a normal way of thinking about things in their culture. That they have professors who would talk, give something about science, and would talk about God inside that scientific lecture, and they would find nothing incorrect about that. So they don't have anything for the kids specifically. I don't know if they do anything. They really see the Bible students as these really deep concepts. And I'm not sure if they can conceptualize how to bring those fundamentals into something that you would teach children. The one sister, Sister Sarah, did mention that the TV that they have in Uganda is not very good and can't use that to entertain the kids. They don't feel good about that. And they asked the brethren to send any kids' videos or things like that that they felt were just good and appropriate so that they could have something to for their children as well. Children are not really an emphasis. In American society, we really put an emphasis on giving the children the best possible raising. And that's not the way in Africa. Children are there at the, you know, the good nature of the parents, and they're treated like little adults. They get up when the parents go up, and they go to bed when the parents go down, and they keep quiet all that time. And if they want any toys, well, they can make them.
Well, along the line of children, I'm just trying to get a concept of what their homes are like, if they have DVD players. Obviously, they've got the DVD, the 53 steps. How many have access to DVD players? How many have access to the Internet? I mean, we've got the BibleStudentKids.com website that we just recently put together, and that's got all of the children's materials that we've produced here. And then also, you know, we're getting stuff from other brethren like Sister Rebecca Gray and different other brethren and putting it on there. Is there some way that they could access that to have some materials for the children?
They really want some personal attention. They want, you know, just in the normal culture, as you walk into the streets and everyone wants your business card and your email. And someone emailed me, as soon as I gave my business card to someone, even before the next day, they already emailed me back and got my out-of-office message at work. And emailed the person who I've said for my work and said, "Oh, can I be your friend too?" And, you know, really, the relationship with someone foreign out of the country is incredibly wonderful to them. It's having that personal relationship. Maybe if you would write to the Sister Sarah, which is Brother Juco's wife, and direct her to that spot, she would be able to get that. They don't have any internet in their homes. It's just too expensive. You'd have to have a whole block of them, and it's just, you can't do that. You'd have to send internet to one home, and that would be, it's more expensive than it is here to have internet. They go to internet cafes, but everyone goes to internet cafes, probably daily, as far as I can tell. Check their email. They have the telephones all the time, and they use the telephones to keep in the local contact. But for business contacts, trying to expand themselves, they do go to the internet cafes. And you can print there at the internet cafes. I don't know how they get the DVDs. I'm not sure if it's different in Kenya, which it was the Kenyan brothers who were really big on the 53 steps.
So do they have DVD players?
They have DVD players, yes they do. They have a generator, or they would get a tap line, for the local neighborhood or something of that sort. Or they would go to people's homes, if someone has a TV, then that's the gathering spot for the whole little community. All your neighbors would come over to your home. And that's the way it's done. So they do have DVD players and VHS players and that sort of thing. I wrote, Brother Allen asked me for a travel journal of my trip. And I wrote about 20 pages of just what I always thought was travel writing. It's a little different than what you would probably see as a Bible student report of something. He edited it down for the newsletter, so there'll be a little segment, a little portion of that, maybe 3 pages of the 20 pages that I wrote in the newsletter. And then there's the whole thing posted online. And it was the brethren really helped me to try and kind of cut it down and make it more into something that was more palatable for the brethren, something more that they're familiar with. But I have my unedited story with me, copies of my unedited report, or my travel journal, really. Sarah is a little concerned about brethren hearing it through my eyes, and that she wants me to, brother, not to misunderstand what I'm saying, and if brethren feel that they can see through my flesh and see the Christ that I'm trying to portray inside, then I welcome you to have a copy of the report. Again, thank you very much for letting me speak today. It was a blessing. I'm glad to share that.